This Migration Policy Europe event, organized with the Bertelsmann Stiftung and held in Brussels in November 2013, focused on effective labor migration management, creating checks and balances while searching for talent. The event featured two panel discussions, one of which focused on integrating labor migration into modern European economies. The panel is moderated by Madeline Sumption of the Migration Policy Institute and features panelists Martin Ruse of Oxford University, Crystal Morehouse of the Bertelsmann Stiftung, and Thomas Liebing of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. Now joining Martin Ruse.
And most of my research is really motivated by very specific policy questions. So a previous book that I edited with Bridget Anderson was concerned with the question, a lot of labor migration starts with an employer saying they need migrant workers. So employers typically tell governments, we need more migrant workers to do the jobs that domestic workers will not or cannot do. And the task then for government is to critically evaluate that claim. How do you evaluate what employers are telling you? What's the labor shortage? How do you measure it? How do you respond to it? So a lot of my policy work in Britain is around that issue. I travel the country talking to employers, critically evaluating what they are telling the government. Now, this particular book, which came out in September, the question here is, what rights do you grant migrant workers after they have been admitted into the country? And what I'm trying to do here, I'll just give away the main message, main conclusion in the first few minutes, and then backtrack. What I'm trying to do in the book is bring together two strands of literature and two strands of debate that typically have been living in isolation. So on the one hand, you have development economists and development organizations, including the World Bank, say that more international labor migration, especially more low-skilled labor migration, would be a very good thing. Why? Because it's very good for raising the wages and household incomes for migrants, and it might also help families back in their home countries. The link between migration and development, of course, is somewhat more contested, but under certain circumstances, more migration can also be good for development. So the World Bank has been issuing various reports calling for the liberalization of low-skilled labor migration programs, policies in high-income countries, because more migration, the World Bank says, there's no more effective strategy for raising the wages of workers in poor countries than giving them the opportunity to work in high-income countries. So more migration is a good thing. At the same time, we've had various UN agencies and lots of migration NGOs point out that the rights of migrant workers are restricted, heavily restricted around the world, and we need to have greater equality of rights. And what the book does is to say that you cannot always have both. And there's a tension between these two objectives. From a global justice point of view, you can argue that both more migration and more rights for migrant workers is a good thing. But in practice, I argue, it is not possible to always have both. And the argument is based on analysis of labor immigration programs in 4 to 6 high-income countries. And that analysis finds that when you look at the admission policies of high-income countries, you can see this trade-off between openness to admitting migrant workers and the rights that migrants are granted after admission. Countries that are relatively open to admitting migrants, so bringing in lots of migrants, tend to be countries that are relatively restrictive with regards to migrant rights. So the extreme case, of course, would be the Gulf states in the Middle East, where you have very large numbers of people coming in, but very severe rights restrictions. On the other end, you have countries in Northern Europe, for example, Sweden, insisting on equality of rights because you have the social democratic model. Equality of rights is very important, but at the same time, admitting relatively few migrants. So there is this tension. And so most of the book, in a way, shows empirically, I think, that the tension exists and is real. And I think this tension between openness and rights raises a host of very difficult but important ethical questions. As always, with normative analysis, there's no one right answer to these questions. The specific question is that I discussed in the book, can we ever justify restricting specific rights of migrant workers if these rights restrictions mean that high-income countries admit more workers? So if rights restrictions lead to more migration, is that a desirable reason for restricting specific rights? And I will make a normative argument at the end of the talk. I mean, I have my own ethical point of view, but I hope that you will, even if you disagree with that completely, I hope you'll find the rest of the analysis still quite useful. So most of the book, in a way, speaks to debates about the global governance of international labor migration, but I think it also has some important implications for national immigration policymaking and also debates within the EU. So just to backtrack, the research really was motivated by this chart, which many of you will be familiar with. It shows you the ratifications by member states of the United Nations of the main international human rights treaties of the world since the 1960s. And as you all know, in 1990, we had the UN Convention on the Rights of Migrant Workers. And the punchline of this chart is that the 1990 Convention, which you have the blue dotted line, is by far the least ratified UN human rights treaty. So the same countries that ratified general human rights treaties don't ratify the 1990 UN Convention. So far, it's mainly sending countries that has ratified the convention. And if you look at the human rights records of the countries that have ratified, very often these are not great. So the countries that have ratified do not have very good human rights records themselves. So many people argue that the 1990 Convention doesn't really create any new rights. It just really reasserts that human rights apply to migrants as well, and I guess that's true. But then it's very interesting that we have countries ratifying the general human rights treaties, but not the migrant workers' rights treaties. That means that most countries do not think that human rights should also automatically apply to migrant workers on their territories. Now, most UN agencies and migrant rights advocates have responded to this chart by saying that we need more campaigning. Migrant rights are human rights that have intrinsic value and must be respected regardless of citizenship. Okay, so rights have intrinsic value. The starting point of my book, in a way, is that in addition to the intrinsic value that rights have, the rights that migrant workers are given in high-income countries also play a very important instrumental role in shaping the effects of migration for migrants, receiving countries, and sending countries. So, for example, the social rights of migrants, so the access that migrants are given to the welfare state, obviously critically determines the fiscal effects of immigration. For another example, whether or not migrant workers are given free choice of employment or are limited to work for particular employers or particular sectors obviously impacts on their wages and therefore on the remittances. So rights have benefits and costs that vary across different rights, that vary between the short and long run. And because rights have impacts, in practice, restrictions of migrant rights are instruments of labor immigration policy. So that's the kind of pragmatic starting point of the book, that restrictions of migrant rights are, in practice, instruments of labor immigration policy. So when I talk about labor immigration policy, I talk about countries having to make three decisions. One, how do you regulate the scale of immigration? How do you regulate openness? Do you have quotas or do you have some other system for regulating the numbers? How do you select? Do you focus on skilled rather than low-skilled, or do you admit a mix of both? And thirdly, and very importantly, what rights do you grant migrant workers after admission? Do you admit them on a temporary or permanent basis? Do you give them access to the welfare state? Do you give them family reunification, and so on? So the argument is that when countries decide on labor immigration policies, they make these three decisions at the same time. And the implication is that you cannot understand what's going on with migrant rights, and you cannot understand why countries restrict rights unless you at the same time look at admission policies. So the primary empirical interest of the book is to find out how are these three things related, openness, selection, and rights, in high-income countries' policies. And to do that, I should say that I'm focusing exclusively here and quite narrowly on labor immigration policies, policies for admitting migrant workers only. When I talk about rights and when I talk about restrictions, I'm always talking about policies on paper, rights on paper, not rights in practice. Again, we can have a debate about the implications of that. So I argue that, you know, when you think of how can you expect high-income countries to regulate openness, selection, and rights? And I suggest three hypotheses. You can expect high-income countries to be more open to skilled than low-skilled because the skilled migration has greater benefits for high-income countries than low-skilled migration. Not saying that there's no benefits from low-skilled migration, but there's likely to be greater benefits from skilled. Some rights are going to be positive related to skill. So rights create costs and benefits which vary by skill level. And I think that the social rights are a good example. So giving a high-skilled migrant access to social housing is going to create less costs for receiving countries than giving a low-skilled migrant access to social housing. So some rights we can expect to vary across skill levels. That means high-skilled workers are likely to be given more rights than low-skilled workers. And finally, if you accept the notion that rights create costs, at least in the short term, if there are net costs to some rights, then we can expect a trade-off between openness and some of these costly rights. So if it is perceived to be costly to give migrants the right to social housing, then the extent to which migrants are admitted in the first place will depend on the extent to which that right can be restricted. So, I mean, that's just an expectation. We can have a debate about different hypotheses. So I've been trying to measure then. What the book does, it measures openness to labor migration, to admitting migrant workers in 46 countries, and the legal rights that migrant workers are granted under labor migration programs. The problem I had is there's no data, so I had to do my own. Had to come up with my own data set, and I looked at 46 countries, all high-income countries. And importantly, my unit of analysis is not countries as a whole, but labor immigration programs. Why? Well, most countries, with the notable exception of Sweden at this point, I think, have more than one labor immigration program for admitting different types of migrant workers. So I'm interested in the relationship between openness and rights. Well, this relationship will vary across skill levels. So I'm looking at labor immigration programs in high-income countries. And I assign all my labor immigration program a skill level. So I say, is that a program that targets low-skilled, skilled, or high-skilled workers? And in EU countries, I'm only focusing on policies toward third-country nationals because that's the immigration that can be controlled. And the data are on 2009. So I'm looking at 104 labor immigration programs in 46 high-income countries. And the only piece of notation that you need to remember as you look at the results is in the first row you see only LS, LS, HS. So that means only LS means labor immigration policies that are specifically designed to admit only low-skilled migrants. LS means policies that are designed to admit low-skilled and maybe others. So as you move to the right, you move toward more highly skilled migration programs. Only HS2 on the right means policies specifically designed to attract more the most highly skilled only. How do I measure openness to admitting migrant workers? Well, I have 12 indicators, including whether or not there's a quota, demand restrictions, is the job offer required, how strong is the labor market test, and supply restrictions to do with the characteristics of migrants. Do the characteristics of migrants make a difference in terms of admission, age, gender, and so on? On rights, I measure there's a separate index then, some separate measure of migrant rights. I look at 23 legal rights that are granted or not granted or restricted under these labor immigration programs. And these are benchmarked against the 1990 convention. So here are some key features of labor immigration programs. I'll spend 6-7 more minutes. Some of the results in a way are not surprising, and that's reassuring for me because it means that the data are not completely mistaken and rubbish. So one result is that over 90% of the labor immigration programs that I've looked at in high-income countries are temporary migration programs. That means they grant temporary permission to reside and work on arrival. Now, some of them grant permanent residence after some time, but 90%. So there's a big literature that says, you know, temporary migration programs are dead, there's been a demise. Well, that's not just not true. I mean, by and large, when we talk about regulating labor immigration programs in high-income countries, we're mostly talking about guest worker programs, temporary migration programs. The permanent programs are really restricted to the more highly skilled immigration programs. But note that even in the purple bit, even on the far right column, only, even among policies specifically designed to attract highly skilled workers only, more than half are actually temporary programs. The first hypothesis, are countries more open, or labor immigration programs that target skilled workers more open than those target low-skilled workers? And the evidence for that is very strong. So just to explain this chart, again, on the x-axis, you're moving from low-skilled programs on the left. As you move to the right, you're moving toward more highly skilled programs. And what's measured on the y-axis is openness to admitting migrant workers. I should have said that all my openness indicators and rights indicators range from 0 to 1. So that means 0 means it's relatively restricted, and 1, it means it's kind of open admission policy. And on rights, 0 means the right is heavily restricted, and 1 means there's equality of rights with citizens. So here I'm measuring openness, and you have a positive relationship. As you move to the right, programs become more open, and the relationship becomes even more pronounced for the most highly skilled programs. Now on rights, this again is a chart that's reassuring because it tells us what we know. This is a spider diagram, and the origin is the 0 point, and in the outer perimeter you have 1. So I'm measuring restrictions of different dimensions of rights in different regions of the world. The closer the line is to the origin, the more this particular right or these rights are restricted. Okay? So what is the region in the world with the most severe rights restrictions? Well, it's the blue line, the light blue line in the center. These are the GCC countries, the Gulf states in the Middle East. So with regard to all dimensions of rights that I've measured, political rights, economic rights, social rights, the GCC countries are the most restricted. And of course we know that from in-depth countries, that's the case. Followed by, again, not surprising, Southeast Asian countries. Malaysia, Singapore, very restrictive with regard to rights. In Singapore, if you're a low-skilled migrant worker, you're not allowed to get married to a Singaporean resident. You're not allowed to cohabit with a Singaporean resident. And if you're a low-skilled female migrant worker, you have to undergo mandatory pregnancy checks every 6 weeks. So very restrictive rights, followed by Europe, Latin America, and the US. Now, what about the relationship between rights and skills? Is it true that more highly skilled programs grant more rights? Well, yes, it is true. There's a positive relationship. Again, as you move from left to right, you're moving from low-skilled to higher-skilled immigration programs. Now I'm measuring the rights restrictions. 0 means there's a lot of restriction. 1 means equality of rights. So it's a positive relationship for most types of rights. So most types of rights increase as the skill level increases, except for political rights. And that's not surprising, because my causal story that I'm telling, the reason why I'm saying countries are restricting these rights is because they do cost-benefit analysis, and they perceive to be a net cost for the national interests of the receiving country. And most, but not all, of my countries are liberal democracies, where it would be very difficult to kind of restrict very basic civil and political rights based on cost-benefit analysis. So just because it's expensive to protect the right of free speech, it's very hard to restrict that right, of course. But with social rights, that's not the case at all. So there's a very strong positive relationship between rights and skills. And finally, what is the relationship between openness and rights? And the answer is, well, these are kind of correlation coefficients that tell you whether or not there is a relationship. And the only statistically significant results are all negative. Sometimes the coefficients are not very strong, but this suggests, I think, very strongly that there can be a tension between access and some rights. And there's lots of case studies as well from the US and the EU where you see that tension in practice. So now, how should we think about this? Well, I think normatively you can have different views about whether you should ever restrict rights in order to have more migration or not. My point is that when you make that decision, I think you should also think about what migrants and what sending countries think and what they do. And many sending countries, of course, are explicitly against equality of rights because they think it's a protectionist policy. So when the Swedish trade unions complain that the Latvian workers that build the primary school in Stockholm are not paid collective wages in Sweden, from a Swedish point of view, that's an argument for inclusion. From the Latvian point of view, it's a blatant argument for protectionist argument. Latvian workers want, to go there under less than the same rights. So I think the best example, of course, just 1 minute, many of you will have followed the debates in the Middle East at the moment, the Nepali workers in Qatar, exploitation. What happened a few weeks ago, the Nepali government and the Qatari government gave a joint press conference saying there's no problem. So the Nepali government says there's no problem with exploitation. Why? Because they're worried about losing access to these countries. So what I'm arguing for is I'm arguing for the liberalization of low-skilled labor migration programs through temporary migration programs that restrict a few specific rights that create net costs for receiving countries and that are perceived to be obstacles to more open admission policy. So the conclusion, to bring it back to the UN, is that some human rights-based approaches suffer from a blind spot because they're primarily focused on protecting existing migrants without thinking about the consequences for the admission of new migrant workers. So crudely put, insisting on equality of rights can come at the price of more restrictive admission policies. And many UN agencies have been quite reluctant to engage with this. I've had more luck with some than others. I've so far had a very hostile response from the ILO, maybe predictably. And the specific policy argument, I'll conclude with that I'm making is that after 25 years of 1990 convention, and no major income country ratifying is, I think it's time to think about a new approach, a complementary approach. So I'm calling for a universal list of core rights that are fewer in number than the 1990 convention, but that have a better chance of being ratified by a greater number of countries. So that would enable countries to maybe admit more migrant workers, but actually it would also create more effective protection for migrants. So anyway, the conclusion is that when it comes to the protection of migrant workers and migrant rights, less is more. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Well, I have a lot of questions, but I'm not going to ask them now, so we're going to move on to the rest of the panel and then gather up the questions afterwards. But thank you very much for that. So, Thomas, now we're going to turn to you. You have 10 minutes.
Thank you. Here today is a joint work that I've done with Jeff Rameau on the fiscal impact of migration to OECD countries. Why is this issue of interest to countries? Why should it be of interest to you? Well, first of all, we have already 13% of immigrants in OECD countries in the population on average, and it's growing. And for a number of reasons, we can expect that the fiscal position is different from that of the native-born, because immigrants have different socioeconomic characteristics. They arrive at a certain time of their life, and some may also go back after a certain time of their life. And last but not least, there's the labor market outcomes are often less favorable than those of the native born. At the same time, we have growing fiscal challenges facing OECD countries, you all know that. And clearly, with demographic aging, there's expected to be further pressure on the budget. So the question is, of course, now, will additional immigration help to alleviate some of these challenges, or will it rather aggravate some of these challenges? So it's a legitimate question to ask. Particularly, and last but not least, this whole in the context of immigrants' use of the welfare system, and you all know the reports that have been in the press over the last couple of months. So we thought it was a good time, with hindsight, to have a deeper look at this issue. And this concern about immigrants' use of the welfare system, it of course relates to a much broader issue about the links between public views on migration and what migrants bring to the country. So here we have looked at the relation between views on the fiscal impact of migration, so to speak. So are immigrants more likely to be net contributors to the budget, or are they more likely to be net recipients of transfers, and openness to migration. So here you clearly see that people who generally believe that migrants are net contributors in all countries have a much more favorable view on admitting further migration than those who do not. And quite interestingly, the dividing line between those who think you should be more open or more restrictive is precisely between those two groups, with the exception of Greece, where it's less favorable for all groups, and the exception of Sweden on the other end. How can you measure the fiscal impact of migration? There's a couple of approaches that you can take. The most basic one, and that's also the one that we have taken because we wanted to cover a maximum number of countries. So we have done this for 29 countries. So we had to take something that is as good comparable as possible, is basically to look what the resident population, what do they pay to the budget, and what do they get out in terms transfers and so on. So that gives you then the net direct fiscal impact if you then also include employer social security contributions of the resident immigrant population in a given year. Of course, then you can get a little bit more fancy than that, and you can say, well, what about other items? Some are pretty easily attributed, like health, education, active labor market policy, like VAT taxes. You have a pretty good personalized estimate for each individual household in that respect. Other items are much more difficult to estimate, what is the impact of an additional migrant household? Think about infrastructure, think about defense, think about interest payments, public administration. And quite often, how do you include those kind of items, that second category of items, often switches the sign. Because as we will see, generally the fiscal impact of migration is pretty low. It's pretty close to zero, neither positive nor negative. And if you, depending on how you attribute these collective items, will change the picture. Then you can try some dynamic modeling. And when you, these models generally try to look at how do additional migration flows have an impact on the budget. And then last but not least, then you can try to have a much broader impact, like to include also the whole macroeconomic impact of migration. And as you move down, get more fancy, then of course, then you have much more assumption, and it gets much more speculative what actually the result is going to be. So what did we find? Well, first, when you just look at the net direct fiscal position, you see that it's positive in most countries, but still it tends to be below that of the native born. You have a few exceptions here down the line, Germany, Poland, where a lot of immigrants are already in pension age. In Germany, the outsider. In Poland, it's also some of the border change, fake foreign born, so to speak. Also, France is a similar issue. A lot of very old immigrants, because pensions, of course, weigh very heavily, and a couple of the subsequent analysis, we have taken out the pension system to get a more balanced picture. And you see the champion in this respect, Switzerland. There's probably no other OECD country that benefits by all measures, however you look at the things, as much from fiscally from migration than Switzerland. And there you don't necessarily see a link with the public opinion, of course. Interestingly. And when you look then, what is driving this little bit lower fiscal impact of immigrants compared to the native-born population in most countries, then you can look at the contributions in terms of taxes paid and contributions paid, and what do they get out in terms of benefits. And then you see actually what's driving differences is not that they get much more benefits. In fact, on the OECD, on average as a whole, immigrants get less benefits in terms of payments and total monetary, even excluding the pension system, than the native born, which is due to the fact that they are quite of the unemployment support, for example, that's paid. It's the sums that immigrants get is much lower than what the native born get, and the same goes to some of the other items. So, what's driving the less favorable impact of migrants to the public purse relative to the native born is the fact that they are less often employed because they pay lower taxes, because they have lower income and are less often employed. So, we did a calculation where we looked at what would be the estimated budget impact if immigrants had the same employment rate of the native born. Oh, here, there's a problem here with that word version. Because here you see only half of the countries. So Sweden would be next to Belgium. So you see that a lot of those high-income countries which had a lot of humanitarian flows, where employment rates of immigrants are low, there, of course, you see also a much more positive impact if you would manage to raise employment rates of immigrants. And I think that's an important issue much more generally for aid on immigrants, because it helps you to view integration as an investment. Integration expenses more as an investment than an expenditure if you then see that a better integration of immigrants, including also, by the way, for the highly educated, where often employment rates are particularly low, could get very significant gains for the budget. So the overall impact of migration on the budget, I already said it at the beginning, and here you have the result underlining this, is on average pretty close to neutral. I mean, like, depending on how you attribute different items, depending if you include the pension system or not, you get something that is in most countries pretty close to zero. So, and that's interesting, particularly if you include some of these other items that we have not shown before, education, health, active labor market policy, where immigrants quite often receive less than the native born. So, what do we conclude from that? First of all, I think it's very important to highlight that whatever estimate you're going to see, you're going to get, it very much depends on the assumption that are underlining these estimates. So we tried really to be very honest in terms of all our assumptions. That's something more. Our focus was more the comparability across countries, and then to have different scenarios depending on how you see things. And quite often, these single country studies that have been looked at, you often cannot avoid its conclusion. If you look at the institution behind it sponsoring it, that's probably more been the driver of the assumptions than of the results some of these studies were getting. Interestingly, some of the things I have not shown, but which are in our chapter, is that the low-educated immigrants have a higher net contribution than the low-educated native-born, which may be a surprise to many. But the reverse is the case for the high-educated. That's where you see those large gaps in terms of contributions. Immigrants, as I said, tend to contribute less to the public purse, but they also receive lower transfers. In most countries, immigrants have a high dependency on social assistance. So that is true. But when they are unemployed, they quite often are not eligible, and we get again to this rights issue, quite often not eligible for unemployment benefits. And social assistance payments, of course, are much lower than what you get in terms of unemployment benefits. And that has implications, again, down the line, because a lot of the programs, the active labor market programs, immigrants do not have access to those because they are not on unemployment support, but rather social assistance, or not on any payments at all. We also see that the fiscal position of immigrants, of course, varies a lot across OECD countries. But what accounts for a large part of this, when you look at it closer, is that it's differences in the composition in terms of entry categories. So clearly the countries that had a lot of humanitarian migration, like Sweden, Denmark, the Netherlands, and so on, they, of course, have a much less favorable fiscal impact than those countries where there's been mainly labor migration and where most of the migration is recent and labor migration, like the southern European countries prior to the crisis. And what we also find is that labor migrants very clearly have a positive budget impact, at least initially, but very few studies look explicitly at labor migration. Most of these fiscal estimates, they say, what is the impact of taking in an additional 5,000 or 50,000 non-EU immigrants, for example? But that's not the policy option. For a policymaker, the option is to take in 50,000 more labor migrants, if possible or not, under some limits, of course, if he or she manages to get those. And not if you just admit a global number, because humanitarian and family migration you cannot control for. And here, there, of course, is a very different fiscal impact than for labor migrants, where it's generally positive. Australia is the only country which uses this actively, and which, of course, showed that it's a very positive fiscal impact for labor migrants, in contrast to other categories. Also, what we found is that age at arrival, of course, if you look at the whole thing in a lifetime perspective, the younger the migrants arrive, the better it is in terms of their lifetime fiscal contribution. Ideally, they come right at the end of their studies, then you have the maximum lifetime fiscal benefit, and the differences are quite large. And interestingly, in most of these systems, and most of the admission systems, plays only a relatively minor role. Even in most point systems, age is a relatively minor component in the weights. And in some systems, like in Europe, most countries, it doesn't play any role in terms of admission of migrants, but it is a very big determinant of the fiscal impact. Interestingly, again, the country that has the strongest fiscal impact modeling of migration, Australia, is also the one that gives most points to age criterion in its selection process. Last but not least, in most countries, as we've seen, the fiscal impact of migration globally seems to be small. But nevertheless, there are large gains to be achieved from the integration of immigrants, as we have shown. And here, particularly women and highly educated, that's where we see the largest possible gains, which are nevertheless large. Thanks a lot.
Great, thank you very much for that. And for those of you who haven't seen Thomas's chapter, it's actually a very readable and analysis that explains some quite technical material very accessibly, so I would definitely recommend that piece. And now we turn over to Crystal.
working on an issue that we frame as a fair deal for talent now for quite a while. And what we're doing is we're trying to change the frame of the way we think about migration a bit. So right now, Europe and many European countries are asking themselves, what's in it for me? What's the best deal? What's the best fiscal impact? How do I streamline integration and get the best integration for society? And these are all legitimate questions, and this is the way that people should be thinking. Yet, we face a paradox when we talk about migration. Europe is going to be the pioneer of demographic decline, managed demographic decline, and looking at the past in order to make policies for the future is going to be a very limited way of trying to make the best of the future. So what I'm going to do is I want to start with just two questions. One is, who's heard of youth unemployment being a big pressing issue right now for us in Europe? Anybody not heard of this? Who has heard that we need more immigration? Anybody not heard of that? So how do you resolve this paradox? And one of the things that I want to point out is that actually we're in a state in which there are two different realities. One that is quite pressing and present today and that is very familiar to us from our past. That is basically looking at this chart on your left that describes youth unemployment and how really since the financial crisis there's been a huge divergence. There's been a high level overall in European countries, but since the financial crisis there has been an extreme rise in youth unemployment in certain countries. And then looking on the right, and I'll make this a little bit bigger so you can see it, and I'll comment on it just in case you still can't see it. We're dealing with the prospects of labor market decline, or decline in the population of our workforces in Europe in quite a dramatic way in the coming decade. And at the end of this century, we as Europeans are only going to represent about 6% of world population. So in essence, when we talk about migration policy today, we definitely need to be aware of all of the issues that we've been talking about thus far, but we also need to be conscious of the fact that it's going to be a different game that we are shifting into, and Europe is going to be a very different player in that game, a much smaller player. So here I've just, to demonstrate this point, I've just brought up two graphs. One is, if you look at the one that says old Europe, there is a gray, lighter population pyramid. That is the population pyramid in 2011, which is quite healthy. And then 2060, these are the projections. And it is around that time, about mid-century, that Europe is going to be in a state of transition where we will have basically a, what I call a demographic roof on the top of a very slim cylinder, an ever slimming cylinder. And exactly at that point, it's important how much pull you have in terms of attracting talent. Because that's the point where all the social security systems are going to be crying out for workers. And on the right, you can see basically the way that we as Europeans will continue to grow now. So, of course, we are in the middle of a situation where we have, in the future, we'll see as a luxury problem, but is an extreme problem for us right now, which is a surplus of talent, young talent. It's not only the quantity of people that we need to be concerned about, but we also need to be concerned about the types of skills people have. And the more scarce talent becomes, the more concerned we are that talent is not wasted, especially domestically grown talent that our governments invest very heavily in financing school and university systems. And if this is a projection from Oxford Economics, and it looks at the year 2021, and you can even see, I think, some surprising imbalances. So a country like Greece, which is now shedding talent, will face skills mismatch problems within a few years. So it's not just about the quantity of people, but it's also about matching skills. And that's an issue that, especially when you think of dropout rates and whatnot within our own countries is going to be a more pressing, a huge issue for our societies. This is just another example to try to drive the point home about why we need a more zoomed out, long-term perspective when we design our labor migration policies. If you look, this is how the working age population is projected to develop around the globe till 2050. And if the outline, the change is in dark blue, that means that there will be more working age population. And if you see, there is only one circle that is not outlined in dark blue, and that is Europe. So we will definitely be the pioneers of a new and forthcoming age, one of demographic decline, hopefully managed, peaceful demographic decline. It will be a time in which we will be thinking about economics in a different way. Now, any time that there is minus 0.1% growth in our economies, we tend to be very worried and frightened about it. But when you think about population declining and workforces getting smaller, this may be quite a normal thing for us to deal with on a quarterly basis. So when we think about how we want to attract talent and the way that we want to design our policies, how many rights we want to allot, what it's going to cost us, it is something that we need to think of not just as a snapshot of what it is today, because today we are dealing with talent surpluses, but we need to think about how this will be in the future. So I want to conclude, this is the last slide, with a couple of recommendations that we as a foundation have been working on, and we're trying to frame this idea as a fair deal for talent and trying to think of migration policies for today, but also in a longer term, and also think of Europe as being the pioneer of having a more sustainable long-term perspective and strategy on talent. And so one thing is the unwilling pioneer. The first point I think I've touched on enough. The second one is that we have a series of information. We have lots of information on flows, how talent moves around the world, but we don't really have that information compiled in a way that we can understand sort of in a real time or close effects of these talent flows. So for example, we have lots of information on remittances. We have information about where students are going. We have lots of OECD data talking about flows of labor migrants and other categories. We don't really have a benchmark in terms of a talent index, and we don't really understand, besides what makes a country unattractive, what actually pulls talent to one location over another. And so one of the ideas that we're toying with is to develop something like that, a talent index, and to better understand what pushes and pulls talent around the world. Of course, companies are also working on ideas. What is a talent hub? How do you develop a talent hub in order to recruit people? Before, it was that you could just build a factory and people would come, because that was the most important thing, was having that factory be in a certain location. But now it's basically talent hubs, Silicon Valley. It's forces that you can't quite predict, that we want to understand better. You can read this on your own. I'll just touch on one last thing and then hand over. One last idea or recommendation that we have has to do with the way that digital education is changing, the way you can invest in education and training, and you can scale it, and you can do that in a borderless way. And so we think that one way to grow talent without borders, to think of growing talent without borders, if most talent is going to originate in Asia and Africa in the second half of this century, then you can't have the strategy just to buy mature talent on the market, but you have to, all countries have to be equally responsible for growing and developing that talent. So those are my points for today. Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you very much. Now we're going to open the floor for questions, but I want to take my privileges as the chair to ask a question to each of the panelists first. I wonder if I could start with you, Martin, and ask you to elaborate on some of the policy lessons for specific governments a little more. You explained quite compellingly, I think, how countries have chosen a position in terms of the on where on the spectrum they're going to be in terms of the rights that they offer and the openness to migration, and that they make these decisions together. If you start to look at the question normatively, did you come across examples in your research where there were countries that were hamstrung by the amount of rights that they were offering to migrants and therefore didn't feel that, you know, can you use this as an instrument to open up more by reducing the rights, or is it more just a descriptive phenomenon that we see, you know, countries positioning themselves on the spectrum? And I was kind of also wondering if in the context of that, you might reflect on some of the exceptions. So obviously, empirically, you've shown that this relationship holds true, but there are some quite notable exceptions, like Sweden, for example, that both offers much more significant rights, especially at the low-skilled level, and also has a very open policy. I'll tell you the others what the questions are, and then you can reflect on them in the meantime. Thomas, I wanted to to ask you how you reflect also on this issue of rights, how you would reflect on Martin's presentation. Do you think, from a fiscal perspective, that rights are expensive? I was particularly struck by your finding that it's not access to welfare systems, but more employment and integration that affect the fiscal cost. And I could almost imagine an argument that actually giving more people rights, if it encourages them to integrate and do better in the market, could actually not be expensive at all. It could be a positive economic effect. And then Crystal, I wanted to ask you, you touched upon attractiveness. And I was wondering what your reflections were on how important rights are for attractiveness and how governments should be thinking about that. So, Martin.
Thank you. No, I think that's a great question. So would, if you restrict rights, would that enable some countries to admit more migrant workers? I mean, is that real? Maybe I'll give two examples. I mean, one from my own experience in the UK. A couple of years ago, there was, of course, a question whether or not the UK should maintain restrictions on Romanian and Bulgarian migrants. And so the Migration Advisory Committee looked at this, and we interviewed various employers, and the social care sector in the UK actually was very vocal, saying that we need, you know, Romanian migrants from Romania and Bulgaria to work in the care sector. And I think actually economically that was quite a compelling case. And in the end, we could not recommend that the Romanians and Bulgarians be admitted, because Home Office lawyers told us that the UK could not restrict the employment of Romanians and Bulgarians to the care sector for more than 1 year. So I'm talking specifically now about the right to free choice of employment. So, you know, many countries, the reason why they want labor migration is because they have specific shortages in certain sectors, in agriculture and social care. So unless you can restrict employment of migrants in these sectors, part of rationale goes away. So actually that was, the government then did not open up, and that was the explicit rationale, that we cannot restrict Romanians and Bulgarians' right to free choice of employment. We have a shortage in the social care sector. We want them to work in social care, but we can't, so we don't admit them at all. So I think if Britain had been in a position to restrict them to the social care sector, there was a good chance they would have admitted them. Sweden is an interesting case. Sweden was a classic case until 2008 of a high rights, low numbers policy. Of course, the trade unions were very strong in kind of making sure that labor migration was limited. Now, more recently, of course, on paper, Sweden has quite an open immigration policy. Now, in practice, they still get relatively few migrants. And I think the story is one to do with rights, in the sense that what I always do is compare Britain and Sweden. So both opened up to East European migrants in 2004. Britain got a very large number of East European migrants. Sweden hardly got any. And I think the primary reason, of course, population size and language, even if you control for that, the primary reason is with the degree of labor market regulations and labor market rights in Sweden. So in Sweden, an employer has to pay migrant workers exactly the same collectively agreed wages as Swedish workers. So in theory, in Sweden, employers cannot use immigration to lower wages. Of course, in the long run, you can say that immigration undermines the Swedish model and so on. Now, in Britain, there's nothing that stops an employer from lowering wages through immigration. You've got a flexible labor market. So I think the number one reason why in Sweden you still have relatively few migrants, despite the on paper open admission policy, is the insistence of very strong equality of rights and wages. So I think Sweden is interesting. So, you know, I mean, Britain now is thinking, how can we have fewer low-skilled migrants and they're discussing the Swedish model. I mean, they're not seriously thinking about heavily regulating the labor market, but at least the Labour Party has said, if we want fewer migrants, what we have to do is start enforcing the minimum wage, maybe raising the minimum wage, regulating recruitment agencies, so more regulation.
Yeah, thanks for the question. I cannot avoid putting one point on the Swedish model, since we have studied that quite extensively in a new series of reviews on the management of labor migration. And I think one point also on the Swedish model, I think the language issue, we should not underestimate it. I mean, like, why, for example, Germany, despite having a very open policy for the highly skilled at least, gets very few flows compared to other countries that have much less restrictive, highly skilled policy. And I would not say that the German labor market, for example, is overly regulated. It's probably because of the language issue. I think that's an important one that we should not forget. But we have looked actually as a complement to our work, and here I get back, make the link with your question, on the type of access which migrants have to certain benefits and to certain non-contributory payments like family benefits and so on. What do different types of migrants have access to? And it was very interesting that we saw that, for example, the settlement countries, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, had a very clear distinction between temporary migrants and permanent migrants. So temporary, they got very little access to any of these payments, virtually none. Whereas on the permanent, of course, there was no distinction whatsoever. Whereas in Europe, the line was much more blurred. And in fact, that's one of the greatest challenges now, putting all that information together, because it's so much blurred in Europe that we get this into a consistent story. But that's certainly due to the fact that in Europe, the whole distinction between temporary and permanent migration is much more blurred, because you almost never get admitted on a permanent basis. You almost always get first admitted, as you know much better than I do, on a temporary basis, and then you get transformed into a permanent later on down the line if things go well. So on the fiscal access to integration programs, I think that's a very, very important point. When you look at, for example, family migrants, that's perhaps where it's the most issue. Family migrants, quite often, the condition for being admitted is that basically there's no burden to the state, that there's a minimum income requirement, which is generally set in a way that family migrants, upon arrival, they do not depend on social benefits. So then these family migrants arrive. The integration programs are rarely targeted at them, except if they're refugees or arriving to refugees, and there are some exceptions. So they come. They are not any burden to the welfare state, of course, because they don't receive any payments. But the counterpart is that they don't have access to any of the programs, neither to the specific immigrant integration programs nor to the mainstream programs, because they also depend quite often on benefits. So you actually see that immigrants are, in most countries, are underrepresented in those programs where you would expect them to be very heavily involved, because they benefit more from it. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges in terms of labor market integration policy that a lot of countries are facing today.
So I'm answering the question on how important rights are for being attractive to migrants. And I would say being attractive to migrants has a lot to do with the soft skills of a country. I think Dimitri would call it body language. Dimitri's the boss of Madeline. So I think rights are important, but a lot of the reasons people move to one place or another have to do with networks, have to do with just their dream or their idea of what that place will be like. And I wouldn't put all rights into one bucket, because I think, for example, family unification rights, that could be quite important to somebody who does not want to be apart from their family. But for the person who is unattached, they may not be so worried about that. So I think that in general, over a long period of time, in order to be attractive, countries need to build up an image of themselves, something like a brand. And Europe as well needs to do that more consistently in showing the advantages of internal mobility and the opportunities of being in this region as opposed to another. Part of that is going to be, I think, improving rights or creating a basic standard set of rights that all migrants, regardless of skill sets, can count on, or at least have a pathway to, with a limited period of time in which they can achieve those rights. That will add to the attractiveness, but I would say it is a percentage or a part of being attractive.
The microphone is not on. You should be preparing your questions, because in a moment after Martin's response, we will be calling on you.
Thank you. Just very briefly, I didn't make that clear thing in the talk. I think it's useful to distinguish, when we talk about rights, between high-skilled migrants and lower-skilled migrants, because I think they're fundamentally different markets. Now, with high-skilled migration, what you have is you have, you know, a relatively large number of countries competing for relatively few highly skilled migrants. And in order to be attractive, you have to offer very attractive rights. And I think the German example of the green card system early 2000 shows that if you have a highly skilled migration program that doesn't give lots of rights, you're not competitive. So in a way, there's a race to the top with regard to highly skilled migration in terms of rights. But with regard to lower skilled migration, I mean, basically high-income countries are facing an unlimited supply of workers in low-income countries who want to access employment in high-income countries. And the starting point is Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and these countries. I mean, terrible restrictions of rights. Nevertheless, millions of workers go there voluntarily to work. So I think my story, the trade-off and the costs and benefits applies mainly to kind of low and medium-skilled migrant workers. High-skilled migrant workers, of course, if you restrict their rights, they're not going to come. I mean, that's an important point to make, yeah.
Thanks. So I'd like to open the floor for questions. We have a roving microphone, I think. Do we? I have Kostas Vitakis.
Hello. I would like to ask Thomas. I remember from previous years that at least the European countries were not in balance when it comes to their natives in terms of fiscal. I mean, they didn't have a fiscal balance. That's why actually we have all these deficits and debts in Europe. So I wonder whether he tried to establish a comparison between countries with big imbalances between natives and migrants and see in relative terms how the migrants count in these kind of exercises.
Yeah, thanks, Costa. That's a very, very good and challenging question. We have looked at this a bit. I mean, like the basic line is again here that it's not that the differences are not very large. I think the main point is always, and that's almost a philosophical discussion, is because it's a huge budget item that you're not quite sure how to attribute it to the migrants. It's like the type of the fiscal deficit and the payments of the interest payments. My point of view is particularly if you think about in terms of admission of more migrants, that's why you're at the end of the day doing this exercise. Should you then include those kind of interest payments that are basically from which people in the past have benefited, or maybe the already resident population, and they have accumulated a type of debt, and now you want to impose that, fiscally, in terms of fiscal accounting, to the newly arriving migrants. So I would argue that you should not include that item. But of course, you could include it. And everything else, you see that immigrants are not very different from the native born, perhaps slightly worse in some countries, but that's not gonna be driving the deficit.
Do we have other questions? Laurent?
Thank you, Laurent, from DG Employment in the European Commission. I wanted to come back to Madeleine's questions to Thomas about how do you interpret the fact that the...
This Migration Policy Europe event, organized with the Bertelsmann Stiftung and held in Brussels in November 2013, focused on effective labor migration management, creating checks and balances while searching for talent. The event featured two panel discussions, one of which focused on integrating labor migration into modern European economies. The panel is moderated by Madeleine Sumption of the Migration Policy Institute and features panelists Martin Ruse of Oxford University, Crystal Morehouse of the Bertelsmann Stiftung, and Thomas Liebing of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. Now joining Martin Ruse.
on average, less favorable fiscal position of migrants is mainly due to their lower contribution and not to higher benefits. I mean, for me, it's indeed about a way of measuring the cost of rights, probably, and whether there is not also the fact, in a way, in the long run, whether the absence of rights is not costly. If you think about if you are able for instance, family reunification only after a long period, if your children are able to learn the language only when they are 10 or 12 compared to when they are very small. And in terms of cost and benefits of giving rights, not giving a lot of rights to migrants, isn't it very costly, or shouldn't be perceived as very costly for the local low-skilled workers in terms of potential social dumping or...
Just a last question. I think, yeah, you're exactly right. I mean, the point I'm trying to make with the book is that there's costs and benefits of rights instrumentally. And I think for most rights that we can think about, there'll be a very strong case that you should grant rights because it benefits the domestic population. So in the labor market, as you say, in order to avoid migrant workers competing with domestic workers because they can be employed at fewer rights, there's a very strong case for granting equality of rights. So I think you're right, there's lots of costs associated with denying rights, and that's why, and the point that I'm making is that, you know, the trade-off occurs only with a few specific rights. I mean, for most rights, there's a very strong instrumental case, in addition to the moral case, for granting these rights, because it's good for the receiving country, not only good for migrants. But that's not, I argue, the case with all rights. Some rights are obstacles to greater admission.
So, yeah. This whole issue of absence of rights, I mean, like, it's a tricky one, because if you look at the thing in, for the European countries, I mean, like, we have done a pretty large question among all our member countries and asking basically which migrant category, which permit to get which kind of access. I mean, like, we have a little bit of different vision on this, because our purpose, of course, was a different one. So we were really focusing on access to benefits from the fiscal perspective. And what we saw actually that in most cases, there's pretty largely access granted. So it's not so much a fiscal issue from that perspective, these types of access restrictions in most countries. It's really a rather marginal issue in terms of the real fiscal impact that these restrictions, where they exist, do have. So it's probably, again, once again, more of an issue of public opinion. And here, of course, you have it has several implications. First of all, it's very clear on the way how immigrants feel in the society, and this whole issue of discrimination, and also the kind of message that you basically convey by restricting those rights. It's probably you're conveying the message that immigrants would abuse those rights to a greater degree than the native-born, and that we don't find any evidence of this being the case. There's some abuse, but it's the same probably for native-born as much as for immigrants. At least we do not find any evidence in our analysis that this is a major problem if you look at the immigrant population as a whole. And last but not least, this absence of rights where it's costly, it's perhaps more in terms of admission, particularly when you talk about family migrants, and that was the point you were mentioning, here we can really measure also the cost of restricting. We have done a little analysis with our PISA data, where we basically look at each year where the children of immigrants arrive late in the host country, how much that costs in terms of lower educational outcomes. And for some European countries, notably, the cost is quite extensive. So if you restrict family migration and you have children in the origin country, then this has, of course, social cost, but it has a very clear cost also in terms of low education outcomes for those children.
Thanks. I'll just add, in bringing in the transatlantic perspective here, is that the U.S. immigration debate, which I'm sure many of you have heard, is a hot potato across the Atlantic at the moment. It essentially hinges right now on the issue of rights for unauthorized immigrants and what types of rights immigrants would get if there is a legalization. And a lot of the debate and contention that we've seen over the last few months have been specific about exactly the issues that we've been discussing today. On the one hand, the people who are pushing for a legalization say that that not granting rights is expensive, and bring up, for example, the issue of competition. For if unauthorized workers have fewer rights in the workplace, then they are more likely to be used to undermine the domestic American workers. On the other hand, people will point to a different set of rights, the rights to citizenship and the rights to use the social welfare system, and arguing that those are too expensive for legalization. So this conversation, I think, gets right to the center of that debate, which we can see playing out across the Atlantic right now. I have a question over here. Do we have the mic?
Okay. First of all, I would like to thank you for your interesting presentation, very inspiring. Concerning the relationship between rights and flows, if I look at the European countries that have reduced employment protection and flexibilized the labor markets, like Spain, Portugal, Greece, since they have done this, they have known a very negative net migration, so very deep negative net migration. And the countries with that are more protective in sense of employment, social security rights, are the strongest economies, Germany, Sweden, etc. They still have a positive net migration. I don't know if this can be a clue for conclusion in economic terms. But another more precise question is the cost of regularization. I mean, you were focused on new accesses or new entries. But a big debate is how much cost having undocumented migrants working in a regular position, and what will be the benefits of regularizing them. I don't know if you have one of the three have some information or data on this.
I can talk about the US perspective, but either of you or Crystal, do you have comments?
I've got one research point here, is that I did some analysis of the impact of legalization on wages in the UK, and I mean, that kind of analysis tends to show that there's a significant positive impact on wages, and thus also on productivity, by giving migrants legal status. So in a sense, that's a plus. Now, my own view, and this is more kind of political point than a kind of research point, is that I think legalization has a lot to do about recognizing the limits of the state. I mean, if the situation is that you will not, people are here and they're going to stay here, and that, it's going to be extremely costly to try to send people back, and you cannot send people back, economies are dependent on them, some sectors, then I think it makes sense to think about legalization economically. I mean, I don't think that, the people who are against legalization, then in a way, I think it begs the question of what the alternative is. And the alternative is continued tolerance of illegally resident migrants. And you could argue that some countries have that as an official policy. Perhaps the US has had that as an official policy. But I think that, I would think that we should try to find better policies than just tolerating illegality.
Thank you. I think it's a very interesting question that you're raising. First of all, I think it's very important to distinguish between irregular status of migrants and illegal or irregular employment. Because in the US, I think some of the estimates showed that the vast majority, I think up to 3/4 of the irregular migrants are actually paying tax and social security contributions. So that, of course, they're basically paying into the system, but they do not get any benefits out of it, which is from a fiscal perspective, of course, for some of these accounts, may be perceived as beneficial, but of course, from many other perspective of human rights and so on, of course, it's a very different issue. But I think that's very important to highlight that you can be in an irregular status and nevertheless contributing to the tax and benefit system, and also the reverse. And I think that's very important, I think, to draw that distinguishing line when you look at also at the impact of regularization and these kind of issues. Clearly, what you see, like, for example, in the case of Italy, where there's been a lot of regularizations, then the migrants, as you know, probably better than I, they've moved on to other jobs, to better paid jobs quite often, and then of course also then they it helped them of course to move out of those irregular activities and domestic employment and so on to some degree.
Yeah, just to add on that, I think one of the issues that's come up in the US, they've had a very long time to consider the costs and benefits of a legalization, because this is something that they've been debating since the last one in 1986, pretty much. And they now have a population of 11 million people. So we have a fair number of studies have been done on the potential economic impacts of a legalization and the fiscal impact. And the main takeaway, I think, is that it is really difficult to measure this with any accuracy. I think, you know, as Thomas pointed out, the assumptions that you make are extremely important. And so you can change the assumptions in order to get the answer that you want. And that is even more difficult when you're talking not about, talking about immigrants being in the country versus not being in the country, but immigrants being in a somewhat different status in the country. And so it's been very difficult to find politically neutral analyses that governments can really rely on in order to make rational decisions on that. Do you have anything to add?
I just wanted to add that I think we need to face the reality that we are going to have to regularize or legalize in regular intervals in all of our countries, because our migration systems are not going to function perfectly. There are always going to be buildups of populations that have entered or overstayed outside of the system. And I think that a lot of the difficulty we have with this issue is because we're always trying to draw the last line. We're going to do it for the last time, right? We're just this one last time we're going to do it. And we push and push and push these decisions beyond the point of it being good for our societies. And I think that the fiscal impacts are one aspect. The social impacts are another. I just think that this is something that our societies have to come to terms with, that we are always going to need to legalize populations.
Thank you. Well, I am dedicated to efficiency, and I have promised that this session will not run over, so I am going to close the floor for further questions. We're going to take a short coffee break and come back in 10 minutes, but I think this has been a really interesting discussion. We've seen quite how much there's a lot of complexity. These are not simple issues. For every argument, there are three or four counter-arguments. A lot of uncertainty in the data, in the impacts of the policies. And so this is certain to this is a debate that is not going to be over soon. Let's put it that way. Anyway, I'd like you to join me in thanking the panel for their contributions.
For more on MPI Europe, its events, and its research, please visit mpieurope.org.